readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. As autumn wends its way along, I bet, like me, your social calendar is beginning to fill up. I love having friends over or bringing a bottle of wine along to a gathering, so I've been finding myself in the grocery checkout very frequently. While I wait in line, I can't help noticing the magazines at the cash register. Wow, as a nation, we are obsessed by celebrity. Brad said this about Jen, Angelina looks anorexic, Sandra bounces back. Is Kate pregnant with twins? Yes, we love reading about stars. And that's what we'll be delving into this week. Celebrity bios, plus a look at the lives of some very noteworthy folks. It's going to be great fun. So settle back and let's turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz, we're there when you can't be.
In the summer of 1974, a 14-year-old girl in Dalton, Illinois, had a dream to become an actress. But this dreamer would find, like so many others before her, it was a long and difficult path from the south side of Chicago to Hollywood. But the funny thing is, it all came true. In Happy Accidents, a memoir, Jane Lynch recounts her improbable and hilarious path to success. In those early years, despite her dreams, she was consumed with anxiety, feeling out of place in her body. To deal with her worries about her sexuality, she escaped in positive ways, such as joining a high school chorus, not unlike the one in Glee. But she also found destructive outlets. Jane started drinking in high school and developed a mean, judgmental streak that turned her into a real-life Sue Sylvester. Then, at 31, Jane started to get her life together. She embraced her sexuality, came out, and quit drinking for good. Soon after, a chance meeting in a coffee shop led to a role in the movie Best in Show, which helped her land a spot in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And then, a series she signed up for abruptly got canceled, making it possible for her to take the role of Sue Sylvester in Glee. Part comic memoir and part inspirational narrative, this book about Jane is just plain fun. The book is read by the author, with a foreword written and read by Carol Burnett.
If I could go back in time and talk to my 20-year-old self, the first thing I would say is, lose the perm. Secondly, I would say, relax. Really, just relax. Don't sweat it. I can't remember a time when I wasn't anxious and fearful that the parade would pass me by. And I was sure there was someone or something outside of myself with all the answers. I had a driving, anxiety-filled ambition. I wanted to be a working actor so badly. I wanted to belong and feel like I was valued and seen. Well, now I am a working actor, and I guarantee you, it's not because I suffered or worried over it. As I look back, the road to where I am today has been a series of happy accidents. I was either smart or stupid enough to take advantage of. I thought I had to have a plan, a strategy. Turns out I just had to be ready and willing to take chances, look at what's right in front of me, and put my heart into everything I do. All that anxiety and fear didn't help, nor did it fuel anything useful. Finally, releasing that worry served to get me out of my own way. So my final piece of advice to the 20-year-old me, be easy on your sweet self, and don't drink Miller Lite Tallboys in the morning. I don't know why, but I was born with an extra helping of angst. and I'd love to be able to blame this on my parents, as I'm told this is good for book sales, but I can't. I grew up in a family that was pure Americana. We lived in Dalton, Illinois, one of the newly founded villages south of Chicago created to house the burgeoning middle class. We were like the subject of a Norman Rockwell painting, except it was the 60s and the 70s, so he would have had to paint us with bell bottoms and a stocked liquor cabinet. I didn't settle into myself as a child, but the family I had around me was entertaining and embraced the life we had. My dad, Frank, was a classic Irish Catholic cut-up. He was always singing a ditty, dancing a soft shoe, or cracking wise while mixing a cocktail. He was almost bald by the time he was 19, and every day he'd smear Sienski sun lotion on top of his naked head, then slap a little VO5 onto his hands and smooth the ring of hair around the sides with a flourish. "How do you like that?" he'd say to himself in the mirror. And singing under his breath, "I've got things to do, places to go, people to see." And after that daily sea and ski ritual, damn if he still didn't end up getting skin cancer on his pate. However, it would be lung cancer that took my dad from us in 2003, and I miss him every day. I can remember my dad when I was really young. So young, it's like Vaseline over the memory, dancing with me in the living room. "Do you come here often?" he'd ask, twirling me around and singing along with Sid Caesar. My dad also did a bang-up Bing Crosby. I loved it when he sang, and we never had to wait very long for it. He'd sing while putting sugar in his coffee, while buffing his shoes, or for no reason at all. He'd make up songs about us, and the more ridiculous, the better. To the tune of Valderie Valdera, he'd sing Jane Ree, Jane Ra. My nickname became simply Aria Ra. He added Anakin's or Erotomy to the end of anyone's name. My older sister was Julie Anakin's. My younger brother, Bob Erotomy. One of his favorite joyous exclamations was Pontiff, Pontiff, from the word pontifical, which was his way of saying fabulous.
Roger Ebert is one of the best-known film critics of our time. He's been reviewing films for the Chicago Sun-Times since 1967 and was the first film critic ever to win a Pulitzer Prize. He's appeared on TV for four decades, including 23 years as co-host of Siskel and Ebert at the Movies. In 2006, complications from thyroid cancer resulted in the loss of his ability to eat, drink, or speak. But with the loss of his voice, Ebert has become a more prolific writer. Life Itself, a memoir, is his candid personal history. Ebert chronicles his struggle and recovery from alcoholism, his marriage, politics, even his spirituality. He writes about his years at the Sun-Times, his life-changing collaboration with Gene Siskel. He remembers friendships with Studs Terkel, Mike Royko, and Oprah Winfrey. He shares his insights on movie stars and directors like John Wayne, Werner Herzog, and Martin Scorsese. Edward Herman narrates this title that's filled with insight, wit, and very sharp observations. Let's listen.
We were born at the beginning of World War II, 4 or 5 years earlier than the baby boomers, which would be an advantage all of our lives. The war was the great mystery of those years. I knew we were at war against Germany and Japan. I knew Uncle Bill had gone away to fight. I was told, "Your father is too old, so they won't take him." He put bicycle clips on his work pants and cycled to work every morning. There was rationing. If Harry Rusk, the grocer, had a chicken, we had chicken on Sunday. Many nights we had oatmeal. There was no butter. Oleo came in a plastic bag, and you squeezed the orange dye and kneaded it to make it look like butter. "It's against the law to sell it already looking like butter," my parents explained. Daddy and Uncle Johnny ordered cartons of cigarettes through the mail from Kentucky. Everybody smoked. My mother, my father, my uncles and aunts, the neighbors, everybody. When we gathered at my grandmother's for a big dinner, that meant 9 or 10 people sitting around the table smoking. They did it over and over, hour after hour, as if it were an assignment. After the war, you could buy cars again. The cars were long, wide, and deep, and I was barely tall enough to see out the window. 3 could sit across in the front seat, and 3 and a child in the back. You filled up at Norman Early's Shell Station. He pumped the gas by hand into a transparent glass cylinder. He gave you green stamps. The great danger was having a blowout. We drove on the Danville Hard Road. It was a one-lane slab. When another car approached, you slowed down and put two wheels over on the side. That was when you had to be afraid of a blowout. One of the rewards of growing old is that you can truthfully say you lived in the past. I remember the day my father sat down next to me and said he had something he wanted to tell me. We had dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese, and that might mean the war was over. I asked him what an atomic bomb was. He said it was a bomb as big as 100 other bombs. I said, I hope we dropped 100 of them. My father said, don't even say that, Roger. It's a terrible thing. My mother came in from the kitchen. What's terrible? My father told her. Oh, yes, honey, she told me. All those poor people burned up alive. How can I tell you what they said? I remember them saying it. In these years after my illness, when I can no longer speak and am set aside from the daily flow, I live more in my memory and discover that a great many things are safely stored away, that all seems still to be in there somewhere. At our 50th high school reunion, Peggy Lynn remembered how self-conscious she was when she acted in a high school play and had to kiss a boy on stage in front of the whole school. She smiled at me. And that boy was you. You had this monologue, and then I had to walk on and kiss you with everybody watching. I discovered that the monologue was still there in my memory, untouched. Do you ever have that happen? You find a moment from your past undisturbed ever since, still vivid, surprising you. In high school, I fell under the spell of Thomas Wolfe. A stone, a leaf, an unfound door. Of a stone, a leaf, a door. And of all the forgotten faces. Now, I feel all the faces returning to memory.
In Dear Carrie, My Life with Cary Grant, Diane Cannon shares the story of her magical romance and stormy marriage to one of Hollywood's most charming, handsome, and famous leading men. Cary Grant was the star who defined Hollywood glamour. She was a bright actress, beautiful and funny. When Grant asked to meet Diane, she assumed it was for an acting part. Not the case. On his arm, she found herself traveling in the inner circles of power and meeting stellar talents like Noel Coward, Jimmy Stewart, Frank Sinatra, and Audrey Hepburn. But behind closed doors, Diane discovered a very different man, a private person with dark family secrets that weighed heavily on him. With rare photos and never-before-seen letters and notes from Cary Grant, Dear Cary is told with poignancy and hard-won wisdom. The author narrates.
I'm sure Mr. Grant will still be there when I get back, I said, if I ever decide to go back. There was a knock at my door. Oops, I said, I gotta go. I hung up and opened the door, and Charles Fawcett, we all called him Charlie, stepped through, kissing me on both cheeks. You ready, he asked. Oh, I need a minute, I said. I was just on the line with my agent. She wants me to fly back to Los Angeles to meet Cary Grant. For a movie, Charlie asked. That's what she says. Oh, if he's going to cast you in something, it's worth the trip. But if it's just a get-acquainted kind of thing, let him wait. I loved Charlie Fawcett. I had met him 2 months earlier in a remote Portuguese fishing village, on the set of a low-budget movie that I've done my best to forget. It was my second movie. My first was The Rise and Fall of Legs Diamond, about jewel thieves in Prohibition-era New York. And that film, along with a string of television credits, had led to the job in Portugal. Alas, we all knew from the start that we weren't making a masterpiece, but the bright side was that we all relaxed about it and had fun. We all lived in the same bed and breakfast, started the morning with good food and strong coffee, laughed our way through our morning table read, and then went off to make the best of another day of second-rate filmmaking. I fell in love with Charlie by the end of that first week. He was a good actor who treated acting as a bit of a lark. His services were in demand, and he earned enough at it to subsidize a low-key, bohemian lifestyle he enjoyed as an American expatriate in Rome. Beyond that, he didn't attach much importance to it. Charlie was truly larger than life. In World War II, he joined the British Royal Air Force as a hurricane pilot,
He fought with the Polish army after the German invasion and fought again for 6 months with the French Foreign Legion in Alsace, then to Greece to take on the communists in the Greek Civil War. As if that weren't enough, in the waning days of World War II, he freed a half a dozen Jewish women from concentration camps by marrying and divorcing each one in rapid succession. That got them an automatic American visa and allowed them to leave France. If I had to choose one word to describe Charlie, it would be noble. I had a little crush on Charlie. The kind of crush that gives you a feeling of boundless emotional safety, along with a little jolt of physical attraction. That makes a friendship really interesting, whether or not you act on the attraction, though it usually is better if you don't. It's the best type of crush, and Charlie couldn't have agreed more. My favorite kind, he once told me. Let's try to make it last. Charlie was a man of experience, a man of the world, and I was a spirited Jewish girl from Seattle, barely past college age, who'd had sex only once in her life, though it was so inept, I'm not sure it even qualified. Charlie was the rare man who placed more value on the unspoiled fabric of our friendship than he did on a night of tangled sheets and awkward see-you-laters. I think he sensed my innocence and figured there'd be enough contenders to relieve me of it without his joining in. Once we bonded on the shoot, we were inseparable. Charlie, me, and Bangs, my beloved Yorkshire Terrier, who joined me in Portugal midway through the shoot. Bangs was my best buddy. Without Bangs on the pillow next to me, I found it very hard to fall asleep. So Charlie invited me to go to Rome with him after the film. "You can bring the mud," he said, scratching Bangs under her chin. "The culture will do her a world of good, and it won't hurt you either. You will be inspired beyond your wildest dreams."
One of the Hollywood greats left us in March of this year. Elizabeth Taylor, the world's most beautiful woman. Of course, you know Liz won 2 Oscars for Best Actress, for Butterfield 8 and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. But in fact, Liz had 3 fairly distinct career personas. As the child star of movies like National Velvet, as temptress in movies like Cat on the Hot Tin Roof, and as an older Hollywood grande dame, AIDS activist and friend to pop stars like Elton John and Michael Jackson. And then there were her 7 husbands and 8 marriages. There's a lot of story there. My guest today, Ellis Amburn, has just updated his acclaimed biography, The Most Beautiful Woman in the World, The Obsessions, Passions, and Courage of Elizabeth Taylor. The book is a candid retelling of a life that was absolutely cinematic in scope. Ellis worked as a reporter-researcher at Newsweek before becoming an editor at Putnam, then at Delacorte and at Morrow. He's edited Kerouac, John le Carré, and Edward Albee. He's collaborated on books by Shelley Winters, Sammy Davis Jr., Lana Wood, and Priscilla Presley. Ellis has also authored books on Roy Orbison, Janis Joplin, Buddy Holly, and Jack Kerouac. Welcome, Ellis. I have to say, I really enjoyed the book. It's a great read. You just don't want to put it down.
Thank you so much, Elaine.
Okay, you have to ask, how and when did you become interested in Elizabeth Taylor?
As a child, I fell in love with her when I saw her in Lassie Come Home. So I followed her career for years. Then I met her in Las Vegas around 59 or 60. When I was standing next to her in a casino, and she just started talking, though we'd never met, because the famous know that somebody is always listening, so they often just burst out with something. And then I was standing next to her at a party for Brooke Shields after the opening of Endless Love in New York, and she was looking at Brooke, who was standing near us, and she said, "Humph, so that's my competition." And of course, Elizabeth at the time, you know, was far past her peak as a beauty, and Brooke was just coming into hers. So but I'd always been fascinated with her, and then I guess it was around 1998, I went out and lived in L.A. for a while and interviewed her friends because I'd always wanted to write about her.
Hmm. Well, really, how did you get started collecting all the material? Because the book is so incredibly detailed.
I went to see my friend Jack Larson, who played Jimmy Olsen on the original TV Superman, and who had known Elizabeth for years, and was very close to Montgomery Clift. So what he didn't learn from Elizabeth, he learned from Monty over the years. And so he was a wonderful source of information. And he's a wonderful guy. He's still alive and living in L.A.
Well, I read in the book that you had one very special dinner with Elizabeth that included Calvin Klein and Andy Warhol in Halston. Tell us a little about that.
Yes. That was when she was trying to help John Warner, now a senator, to become a senator. And he, you know, a lot of us make mistakes in our midlife and senior years by getting involved with younger people. And she made a couple of bad choices, and he was one of them, because he had earlier hit on Barbara Walters and told her, a woman like you could probably help me get elected senator. So Elizabeth was putting a lot of energy into John Warner, which is tragic because they're poles apart politically.
All right. Well, since you brought it up first, let's talk about those marriages. Nikki Hilton, Michael Wilding, Mike Todd, Eddie Fisher, Richard Burton, again, Larry Warner, Larry Fortensky. So tell us, you know, some people think that I've heard it said that Elizabeth Taylor never had intimate relations with anyone until she was married. So share some insider scoop on that.
Well, Vic Damone, she and Vic Damone, who were both at Metro in the 40s, they had an affair. And she was a teenager, and she was so possessive that when he dumped her, she got Louis B. Mayer because she was worth a million times more than Vic Damone to Metro. And she got Louis B. Mayer. She pulled a sit-down strike on her picture and told the head of Metro that he was going to need to fire Vic Damone unless he took her to dinner. And so the choices that she made for husbands were all wrong. Nikki Hilton beat her up and, as she put it, kicked a baby out of her stomach on their honeymoon. So he was nuts. Michael Wilding was unemployable, and she was a very expensive wife to have, insisting on jewelry and maids and everything. And they really didn't make that much money in those days. I mean, by the standards of today's wealth. I think she was getting about $150,000 a year and had to have nurses and nannies for the three children she had with Michael Wilding. Mike Todd, she's lucky that the marriage only lasted 440 days before his death, because Joan Blondell years later told me that he was so violent that he dangled her from a high story of the Waldorf Astoria by her ankles during a fight. Then, let's see, who was next? Eddie Fisher, drug addict, hopeless. Then she married Richard Burton twice. He, by his own admission, was a little bit gay and hated what he did. He absolutely despised, he was ashamed to be an actor, and wanted to be a teacher and a writer. So he was a very miserable man. Then she married a caterpillar dirt compactor. Well, at first there was John Warner, who we've already talked about. Then there was Larry Fortensky,
right,
a construction worker, who was, you know, an alcoholic hanger-on who she met in rehab. Violating every rule of rehab. You're not supposed to have sex for a year when you're trying to get sober.
So, I mean, of these men, which would have been the love of her life? Richard Burton? Or was there someone else that she didn't actually marry who would get that title?
Montgomery Clift, who was gay, was the love of her life. She went to gays for love. She went to straight men for sex, and that's probably why it never worked out. But she and Monty were close friends for life. Of the men she married, she always said that she loved Mike Todd passionately, and then she never speaks of Richard Burton with anything but the deepest love, though he once called her a low, scurrilous creature. But, you know, they were drunks, and that's what alcoholics do, is abuse each other. But in its own way, I guess it was a great love story. Certainly it was to her.
Hmm. Actually, I read something in your book that I had never heard, that Elizabeth's father, an art dealer, was also suspected to be homosexual.
Yes, he had a love affair with a costume designer named Adrian. It's just mind-boggling what she accomplished, considering the weight of pain and misery that she carried. Elizabeth was always enabling the men in her life. At that point, she was trying to make an international star out of Richard Burton, who had never made it in America. He'd been in The Robe and other movies, but he'd never become a box office champ the way she was. That's one reason he married her. And so she made movie after movie with Richard Burton. And on screen, married couples have absolutely no chemistry. There's not a single thing they did together except for and they made 7 or 8 movies together. There was one good one, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? But she should have been working with people who wanted to work with her at that point, like Paul Newman.
When Liz was at the height of her movie career, did she actually have starlet friends, or were actresses afraid she'd steal their man?
what a good question. And she, like most alcoholic women, had few girlfriends. She could have used them. She could have used a psychiatrist and girlfriends. So she was always going to men to fix her unhappiness. And, of course, we can only fix our own unhappiness.
Yeah.
But some girlfriends would certainly have been a great asset in Elizabeth's. People she could talk with no agenda, and people who had no agenda.
Yeah. Well, in all her film roles, was there one role that she most closely identified with or felt proudest of? I know she won 2 Oscars for Best Actress, but which was her favorite?
Well, one she hated, which I loved, by the way, was Gloria Wandress, the prostitute in Butterfield 8. The one she loved, she loved playing Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, because it was exactly the way Martha and George tore into each other alcoholically was exactly the nature of her marriage with Richard Burton. So all they had to do in that was play themselves. Mm-hmm. She loved the role she worked so hard to get, Leslie in Giant, who was the first liberated woman in the movies. That was about 1955. The wonderful role. Jennifer Jones tried to get it. Grace Kelly wanted it. Audrey Hepburn was up for it. And Elizabeth got it because Rock Hudson, who was the hottest new star in the world at the time, told George Stevens he wanted to work with Elizabeth Taylor. And I think that's one reason Elizabeth remained his friend all those years, and including when he was in disgrace, when he was dying of AIDS, when that was still thought of as a disgrace. She stood by Rock Hudson right to the end, bless her heart.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, on to my favorite topic, the jewelry. Where and when did she get started with that collection, and what's happened to it, actually?
Well, her mother gave her a pretty little, I think it was a necklace, or it might have been a brooch. And it didn't have any precious gems in it, but it meant a lot to Elizabeth. And so she then found, with her great beauty, that when she asked a man for a $30,000 tiara, as she did Mike Todd, she would get it. And so that became a habit with her, and she put together this great collection, which will be sold in December at Christie's. Mm. But the most hideous piece of jewelry in the collection, Michael Jackson gave to her. It's a monkey necklace, and it is priceless. I've never seen so many diamonds in my life, but it is ridiculous and ugly.
Well, talk a little about that relationship. It's a little strange, so give us some insight on that relationship.
Yes, Michael Jackson, as a drug addict, was helpless, as all are. He needed someone to run his life because he had no judgment and was always loaded. So Elizabeth Taylor stepped in, and in a lot of those trials for child molestation and so forth, it was Elizabeth who was running a team of 8 lawyers, and she also smuggled him to England to a rehab when he was afraid of being arrested at one point.
How did they meet? How did they meet, actually?
He showed up at her door with his monkey.
Ellis, tell us about your next project.
My next project, at last, after writing 12 books about other people, Kim Novak, Shelley Winters, Peggy Lee, it's time to write about Ellis Ambern the same way I wrote about them.
Well, I have to say, after reading your book, The Most Beautiful Woman in the World, you are one of a writer.
Well, thank you. I believe I'll call it The Life That Late He Led.
All right, Ellis, we'll look for it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Elaine. It was all kinds of fun.
Okay, I digress, but just a bit, and for a very good reason. Here is a memoir of a year, not a person. January 1970, the Beatles assemble one more time to put the finishing touches on Let It Be. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young are wrapping up Deja Vu. Simon & Garfunkel are unveiling Bridge Over Troubled Water. James Taylor, an upstart singer-songwriter, has just completed Sweet Baby Jane's. Over the course of the next 12 months, their lives and the world around them will change irrevocably. Fire and Rain, The Beatles, Simon & Garfunkel, James Taylor, CSNY, and The Lost Story of 1970 tells the story of 4 iconic albums of 1970 and the lives, times, and constantly intertwining personal ties of the remarkable artists who made them. Acclaimed journalist David Brown sets these stories against an increasingly chaotic backdrop of events. Kent State, the Apollo 13 debacle, ongoing bombings by radical left-wing groups, and the diffusion of the anti-war movement. Featuring candid interviews with more than 100 luminaries, including some of the artists, Brown's narrative tells the story of how, over the course of 12 turbulent months, the 60s ended and the 1970s began. Sean Renette narrates.
This book has its roots in that most devastating of traditions, classroom humiliation. One Christmas, long ago, my parents asked me for a list of possible gifts, so I gave them the names of a few records. Only months before, for my 12th birthday, I'd received my first LP, making the momentous transition from singles to albums. A twerp to cool kid rite of passage that's since gone the way of the turntable. Since my older sister Linda had already introduced me to the music of Simon and Garfunkel, I asked for one of their albums for my own. Our first day back after winter break, my classmates and I at our elementary school in Hazlitt, New Jersey, filled each other in on our presents. When my turn arrived, I proudly announced I'd been gifted with an album. "What one?" they asked. "Simon and Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence," I replied. Their aghast looks, the way they pulled back from me, as if I'd admitted I couldn't wait to get home to start homework every day, was the first sign something had changed. Then one of them said, in a tone equally puzzled and contemptuous, "Why do you want that old music?" All my surrounding classmates then turned, en masse, away from me. Yes, the album was 6 years old, an eternity for a teenager. But from my friends' reactions, you'd have thought I'd been given a collection of Stephen Foster parlor songs from the middle of the previous century. Hadn't the 60s just ended? I had to admit those years already felt farther away than they were. Repeatedly, those of us who came of age in the 70s were reminded we'd missed out on the most astounding era in history, a flowering of culture, society, and mankind like none before, and with girls in miniskirts to boot. Compared to that, our era was an even darker Dark Ages. Welcome to a world of Watergate, Casey and the Sunshine Band, 50s nostalgia, and gas rationing, we were told. Personally, I loved hearing early disco songs on the radio and happily watched Fonzie say, "Hey!" Yet I still wondered, what happened? And how did it happen? When did the hopeful sensibility of one era give way to the dimmer one of another? The question has tugged at me ever since. If friends my age are drawn to the 70s, it's generally the second half, the momentous years of punk, Studio 54 disco, the original cast of Saturday Night Live, the films of Lucas and Spielberg. But the messy, conflicting signals of the first half of the decade have always haunted me. Utopian music like prog rock, alongside post-utopian movies like Deliverance, men pushed too far action films like Billy Jack and Walking Tall, next to an anti-establishment, pacifist central TV series like MASH. And everywhere was the fragmentation of so many of the classic bands of the 60s, replaced by flaxen-haired troubadours sweetly serenading the ladies. The Frisbee Guys, as my friend Tom and I call them. After Sounds of Silence, some of the first LPs I ever owned were all the other Simon and Garfunkel albums. Bridge Over Troubled Water spun regularly on the close-and-play stereo in my bedroom. The Beatles' Let It Be, and everything recorded by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, together, separately, or in duo form. I didn't have to buy James Taylor's Sweet Baby James. I always seemed to hear its low-maintenance melodies drifting out of my sister Colette's bedroom. Many years later, during a brainstorming session for my next book, my wife suggested I write about the music I loved in my childhood. Meaning not just Simon and Garfunkel, but Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Beatles, James Taylor, and so on. As she rightly pointed out, I was still giving cursory listens to those musicians' new releases, attending their reunion concerts, even interviewing them for one outlet or another.
In the summer of 1916, Dorothy Woodruff and Rosamond Underwood, close friends and graduates of Smith College, left their New York home for the wilds of northwestern Colorado. Bored by society luncheons, charity work, and effete young men who courted them, the two women applied for teaching jobs in a remote mountaintop school. Friends and family were shocked. No young lady in our town, Dorothy later commented, had ever been hired by anybody. Author Dorothy Wickenden tells their colorful tale in Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West. She chronicles how the pair took the new railroad over the Continental Divide and made their way by wagon to the tiny settlement of Elkhead. They lived with a family of homesteaders and rode miles to school each day on horseback, sometimes in blinding blizzards. Their students walked or skied to school in tattered clothes and shoes held together by string. The man who lured them out west was Ferry Carpenter, a witty, idealistic, and occasionally outrageous young lawyer and cattle rancher. He'd promised them the adventure of a lifetime, and boy howdy, that's what they got. The year transformed their students and the two women. Dorothy and Rosamond lived in a place and time suffused with a sense of adventure and possibility. Dorothy Wickenden, who narrates along with Margaret Nichols, beautifully captures a world in transition, a pivotal chapter not just in the life of her spirited grandmother, but also in the life of the American West.
Auburn was a stop on the Underground Railroad, and some of the families they knew had hidden runaway slaves in their basements. Dorothy's grandfather lived next door to William Seward, President Lincoln's Secretary of State. One day when she was visiting my family in Weston, Connecticut, she recorded an oral history, speaking with unerring precision about her childhood and about her time in Colorado. Retrieving the transcript of the tape, I was reminded of the breathtaking brevity of America's past. I remember Dorothy as white-haired, impeccably attired, and sometimes stern. The second youngest of seven children, she grew up in a big, hip-roof, clapboard house staffed by servants. Her bedroom and that of her younger sister, Millie, were in the nursery reached by the back stairs. Raised largely by their nursemaid, they rarely stepped into the kitchen. When Dorothy's four children were growing up, she didn't know how to cook anything except creamed potatoes and hot cocoa. Every night she brushed her hair 100 strokes with a French boar bristle brush. She joked to us about her height, 4'11" and shrinking every year. To reach her high mahogany four-poster bed inherited from her parents, she had to use a footstool upholstered in needlepoint. She gave me tips in etiquette, how to file my nails, how to set a formal table, how to avoid acting common. When I was a slouching teenager, she showed me how she had been taught to walk across the room with a book balanced on her head. On my 18th birthday, she wrote to me, "To be happy, it is necessary to be constantly giving to others. I do not mean to give and work alone, but all of yourself. That means interest in other people, not only by affection, but by kindness." She didn't like the fashions of the 1970s. Curtains of hair, tie-dyed T-shirts, and tight bell-bottoms. And once told me haughtily, "I never wore a pair of trousers in my life." For all that, she was spirited and funny, not at all the deferential young woman she had been brought up to be. After she and Roz returned from Europe, they attended friends' weddings, along with traditional luncheons and balls. But 6 years later, they were still uninterested in the suitors who were interested in them. Chafing at the rigid social routines and not getting anywhere with the ineffectual suffrage work they had taken on, they didn't hesitate when they heard about two teaching jobs in Colorado. The 9 months my grandmother spent there seemed to have shaped her as much as her entire youth in Auburn. She was full of expansive admiration for the hard-working people of Elkhead, and when she faced great personal difficulties of her own, she called to mind the uncomplaining endurance she had witnessed in the settlers and their children. She and Roz, like other Easterners going west, were time travelers, moving back to the frontier. Although they ventured out after the first settlers and went by train rather than covered wagon, their destination felt more like 1870 than 1916. They took with them progressive ideas about education, technology, and women, and postcards from their travels abroad. The homesteaders, motley transplants from across the country, Europe, and Russia, lived almost 20 miles north of Hayden. Effectively cut off from modern life by poverty and the Rocky Mountains, the pioneers found the two women as exotic as Dorothy and Roz found them. Although World War I was looming, such a cataclysm was unimaginable to Americans who knew nothing of combat. Dorothy sometimes talked disparagingly about her grandfather's brother, who had avoided service in the Civil War by paying a substitute to take his place, a common practice among wealthy families in the North. Just weeks before Dorothy and Roz left for Colorado, President Wilson averted war with Mexico. The prevailing spirit among the elites of Auburn, the industrialists of Denver, and the homesteaders of Elkhead was an exhilarating optimism about the future. These people were swept up in some of the strongest currents of the country's history, the expulsion of native tribes, the mining of gold, silver, and coal, the building of a network of railroads that linked disparate parts of the country and led to the settlement of the West, the development of rural schools, the entry of immigrants, African Americans, and women into the workforce in the voting booth, even the origins of modern dance.
From the author of the best-selling Matterhorn comes What It Is Like to Go to War, a book about the psychological and spiritual toll war takes on those who fight. In 1969, at the age of 23, Carl Marlantis was dropped into the highland jungle of Vietnam, an inexperienced lieutenant in command of a platoon of 40 Marines who would live or die by his decisions. Marlantis survived and was awarded the Navy Cross, the Bronze Star, 2 Navy Commendation Medals for Valor, 2 Purple Hearts, and 10 Air Medals. But like many of his brothers in arms, he's spent the last 40 years dealing with his war experience. Bronson Pinchot narrates this deeply personal look at what it's like to experience the ordeal of combat.
The preparation for these aspects of combat must be done by the individual, in the quiet places, alone, in communion with his or her own heart and soul. It would probably be better if such soul-searching were done before an individual volunteers for military service. But I am well aware that 18-year-olds are not known for introspection. This is one of many reasons why young people, particularly young men, make the best warriors. However, imminent maiming and death do help motivate young warriors to contemplate these more serious aspects of their profession. So if by reading this book before entering combat, a young warrior can be helped to better handle the many psychological, moral, and spiritual stresses of combat, then the book will have been worth writing. In addition, if the ideas discussed here help citizens and policymakers attain a clearer understanding of what they are asking of their warriors and of their own role in sending them into the moral quagmire and sacrificial fire called war, then the book will have succeeded, if not beyond my hopes, perhaps beyond my expectations. 1. Temple of Mars. Warriors deal with death. They take life away from others. This is normally the role of God. Asking young warriors to take on that role without adequate psychological and spiritual preparation can lead to damaging consequences. It can also lead to killing and the infliction of pain in excess of what is required to accomplish the mission. If warriors are returned home having had better psychological and spiritual preparation, they will integrate into civilian life faster and they and their families will suffer less. But the more blurred the boundary is between the world where they are acting in the role of God and the world where they are acting in an ordinary societal role, the more problematical the reintegration becomes. The sun had struggled all day behind monsoon clouds before finally being extinguished by the turning earth and the dark, wet ridges of the Andes Cordillera. It was February 1969 in Quang Tri Province, Vietnam. Zoomer lay above my hole in monsoon night blackness on the slick clay of Mutter's Ridge, the dark, jungle-covered ridge paralleling Vietnam's demilitarized zone, where the 3rd Marine Division and the North Vietnamese Army had struggled together for 2 years. A bullet had gone through Zoomer's chest, tearing a large hole out of his back. We kept him on his side, curled against the cold drizzle, so the one good lung wouldn't fill up with blood. We were surrounded, and there was no hope of evacuation, even in daylight. The choppers couldn't find us in the fog-shrouded mountains. I heard Zoomer all night, panting as if he were running the 400, one lung doing for two and a body in shock. In and out. In the fog, the sighing sound of monsoon wind through the jungle. Out the hot, painful breath. Zoomer had to go all night. If he slept, he'd die. So no morphine. Pain was the key to life.
Okay, you may have never voted for him. I know I haven't. But you've been intrigued by him. The public perception of Dick Cheney has long been a contradiction. He's been viewed as one of the most powerful vice presidents, secretive, even mysterious, and at the same time opinionated and unflinchingly outspoken. In My Time, a personal and political memoir, former VP Cheney, with his wife Liz, delivers an unyielding portrait of American politics over nearly 40 years. Born into a family of New Deal Democrats in Lincoln, Nebraska, Cheney came of age in Casper, Wyoming, playing baseball, football. He was the senior class president. This all-American story takes an abrupt turn when Cheney flunks out of Yale and signed on to build power lines in the West. Cheney got himself back on track and began an extraordinary ascent to the heights of American power. He became the youngest White House chief of staff for President Ford, was elected a congressman from Wyoming, became CEO of Halliburton, was appointed George H.W. Bush's Secretary of Defense, and George W. Bush's VP. Cheney's been on all the talk shows lately, and there's quite a buzz about this book, narrated by Edward Herman and Cheney. So let's hear a bit of it.
Norm was working two telephones, with the FAA on one and his chief of staff on the other, trying to get the skies cleared until we knew just what we were dealing with. A commercial airline pilot usually has wide discretion to handle his aircraft in an emergency, and apparently someone said something to Norm about pilots deciding when and if to bring their planes down. I heard him say in no uncertain terms that pilot discretion would not be the rule today. "Get those planes down now," he ordered. In those first hours, we were living in the fog of war. We had reports of 6 domestic flights that were possibly hijacked, a number that later resolved to 4. We had conflicting reports about whether the Pentagon had been hit by a plane, a helicopter, or a car bomb. We started getting reports of explosions across Washington, at the Lincoln Memorial, the Capitol, and the State Department. We heard there was an unidentified, non-responsive plane headed for Camp David and another headed for Crawford, Texas. We also received word of a threat against Air Force One. At about 10:15, a uniformed military aide came into the room to tell me that a plane, believed hijacked, was 80 miles out and headed for D.C. He asked me whether our combat air patrol had authority to engage the aircraft. Did our fighter pilots have authority, in other words, to shoot down an American commercial airliner believed to have been hijacked? "Yes," I said, without hesitation. A moment later, he was back. "Mr. Vice President, it's 60 miles out. Do they have authorization to engage?" Again, yes. There could have been no other answer. As the last hour and a half had made brutally clear, once a plane was hijacked, it was a weapon in the hands of the enemy. In one of our earlier calls, the President and I had discussed the fact that our combat air patrol, the American fighter jets now airborne to defend the country, would need rules of engagement. He had approved my recommendation that they be authorized to fire on a civilian airliner if it had been hijacked and would not divert. Thousands of Americans had already been killed, and there was no question about taking action to save thousands more. Still, the enormity of the order I had just conveyed struck all of us in the PEOC, and a silence fell over the room. Then Deputy Chief of Staff Josh Bolton leaned forward in his chair and suggested we get in touch with the President to let him know what had just happened. At 10:18, I picked up the secure phone in the drawer beside me and called Air Force One, which had left Florida and was heading west as the President's aides looked for a secure location from which he could address the American people. When the President came on the line, I told him about the shoot-down order. There soon followed some tense moments when we got word that an aircraft was down south of Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Had it been forced down? Had it been shot down by one of our pilots following the authorization I'd conveyed? Eventually, we learned that an act of heroism had brought United Airlines Flight 93 down in the fields near Shanksville. Aware of the fates of the other planes hijacked that morning, the passengers on Flight 93 stormed the cockpit. By sacrificing their own lives, those brave men and women saved the lives of many others, possibly including those of us in the White House that morning.
Ooh, I love a good juxtaposition, don't you? So here comes Trouble, Stories from My Life, written and narrated by Michael Moore. In this anti-memoir, Moore breaks the autobiographical mold and presents 20 far-ranging, irreverent vignettes from his own life. Moore is his own Forrest Gump, as one moment he's an 11-year-old boy stuck on a Senate elevator with Bobby Kennedy, and the next he's inside the Bitburg Cemetery with a dazed and confused Ronald Reagan. Changing planes in Vienna, he escapes death at the hands of the terrorist Abu Nidal. He refuses to be on CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite at age 16. And he became the youngest elected official in the country at age 18 by enlisting an army of local stoners. All of this is the stuff that makes for great fiction, but every one of these stories is true and from the life of Michael Moore, a son of Flint, Michigan, who became an iconic voice for American progressives everywhere. But before Michael Moore became the Oscar-winning filmmaker, all-round rabble-rouser, and thorn in the side of corporate and right-wing America, there was a guy who had an uncanny knack of showing up just where history was being made. This is a book Michael Moore has been writing and living for a very long time.
What you're about to hear is a book of short stories based on events that took place in my early years. Many of the names and circumstances have been changed to protect the innocent, and sometimes the guilty. They say that memory could be a strange and twisted amusement park, full of roller coaster rides and funhouse mirrors, frightening freak shows and gentle contortionists. This is my first volume of such stories. I wanted to commit them to paper, while paper and bookstores and libraries still existed. There's this great scene in Woody Allen's film Stardust Memories, where he plays this character, Sandy Bates. He's a film director, and he's going through a midlife crisis trying to figure out, should he continue to make movies, or, you know, what's the meaning of life? And all of a sudden, an alien appears to him from outer space. And he goes up to the alien and asks him this question: shouldn't I stop making movies and do something that counts, like helping blind people or becoming a missionary or something? And the alien replied, "Let me tell you, you're not the missionary type. You'd never last. And incidentally, you're also not Superman. You're a comedian. You want to do mankind a real service? Tell funnier jokes." I begin this book with the epilogue from a future book I've yet to write, The Execution of Michael Moore. The following is an actual quote from Glenn Beck that he spoke on his radio program on May 17, 2005. "I'm thinking about killing Michael Moore, and I'm wondering if I could kill him myself, or if I would need to hire someone to do it. No, I think I could do it. I think he could be looking me in the eye, you know, and I could just be choking the life out of him. Is this wrong? I stopped wearing my 'What Would Jesus Do?' band, and now I've lost all sense of right and wrong. I used to be able to say, 'Yeah, I'd kill Michael Moore,' and then I'd see the little wristband that said, 'What Would Jesus Do?' And then I'd realize, oh, you wouldn't kill Michael Moore, or at least you wouldn't choke him to death. And you know, well, I'm not so sure." Wishes for my early demise seemed to be everywhere. They were certainly on the mind of CNN's Bill Hemmer one sunny July morning in 2004. He'd heard something he wanted to run by me. And so, holding a microphone in front of my face on the floor of the 2004 Democratic National Convention, live on CNN, he asked me what I thought about how the American people were feeling about Michael Moore. "I've heard people say they wish Michael Moore were dead." I tried to recall if I'd ever heard a journalist ask anyone that question before on live television. Dan Rather did not ask Saddam Hussein that question. I'm pretty sure Stone Phillips didn't ask serial killer and cannibal Jeffrey Dahmer either. Perhaps maybe Larry King asked Liza once, but I don't think so. For some reason, though, it was perfectly okay to pose that possibility to me, a guy whose main offense was to make documentaries.
Readers, stories about remarkable folks always grab my interest. When you're looking for the next great story to pick up, check out my website, bookreportradio.com. It's my job to search for new titles that are worth your time, and I love my job. So thanks so much for joining me today, and see you next week on The Book Report.